or talking about the footage that's been playing in the background that we've given no context to over the past several episodes.
So
sorry, you can explain. I ramble a lot.
No, you go again. You go ahead. You totally have this explanation.
Oh, okay. Well, because we were thinking like, okay, what should go in the background of these things? And I was like, well, the easy thing would be to put just like the two, like a painting or our two character avatars just sort of sitting there. But when I started my new sort of batch of YouTube content, I was just screen capping the whole day with the anticipation to time lapse it and dub it and sort of make pseudo tutorials out of it. But at the end of the week, trying to dub a compressed 30 hours of footage and try to explain, this is how I built this rig, I'm gonna use this. It was insane.
It didn't work out and it wasn't
It didn't
working.
work out, no.
Was it that you couldn't condense the footage down into something? Because I see live speed paints all the time on YouTube and people just talk over them. It's really not my kind of content. I don't really watch that stuff. But I just find it surprising that you had all this footage and you tried dubbing over it and it didn't work out. Did you just not like it?
It's more that I couldn't explain it in a way that was useful. I thought a really easy way to, I was hoping that a way to kill two birds with one stone, tutorial wise, would have been to just make stuff out of things I was already making. So a lot of people want to know how to rig characters properly in their entirety. I was like, well, that's cool because I'm going to be rigging this character. What if I just work at my normal pace and then explain how I did it later? But of course, some bits that require a lot of explanation are over very, very quickly because they're only a few steps, but they're crucial steps. Meanwhile, something like inking is a very long-winded process. It can take a full day or so, but there isn't really a whole lot to talk about. When it comes down to it, you're just tracing the roughs.
Yeah,
So.
I was gonna say, I mean, trying to do a tutorial that way, it wouldn't be very clean. Your tutorials are already
No.
they're very short and to the point and easy to understand, but that's because you plan and edit them. If you're just grabbing whatever footage you had for the day and trying to make it fit, I can see why you would have a problem.
Exactly. So it was worth experimenting with because it's through that method you find out what works and what doesn't. But in the end, I still enjoyed recording everything I was doing and then just sort of watching it back to myself at the end of the day because every success and error was very visible. And it's just a way of keeping myself accountable. If the screen just went blank for ages, I could speed it up by 60 times, so a minute became a second. So if it was blank for 5 seconds, I'd be like, well, what was I doing during that time? A lot of the time
That's
it was maybe
really
like just like checking Messenger or having a brief conversation with someone. And at the time, you don't really think about it. But when watching it all sped back, it's like, man, that was a big chunk of my day that sort of just happened and didn't even realize it.
Oh, yeah, that I was gonna say keeping track of that kind of stuff. That's a really odd way to do it. I feel like I would end up wasting a lot of time if I tried to do it your way. I'm aware that I'm getting distracted a lot, but I just haven't figured out how to not do that, like not go in and respond to people's questions about, hey, I want this piece of art done.
Oh, you should probably try playing Willpower, the game I haven't actually explained to anyone
The
yet.
game that isn't done yet.
It's not
Oh.
done yet. I'm not ready to talk about it properly yet. I need more bits done. I want to have like a working prototype and then I can be like, okay, this is the thing. And then, okay, everyone, you can give it a try very, very soon while it's still like, because like my audience is very small, so I can sort of just open it up to everyone and be like, hey, everyone play it and tell me what you think. And if it sucks, tell me so I can make it not suck. But at the end of it all, I guess getting back on topic, meant there was a lot of footage left over, and I still enjoyed making it, and it was almost like a form of personal journaling, but there wasn't a way to put it onto the channel in a way that would have been beneficial to viewers anymore.
Yeah, no. It's the same thing. It's same so for on my end, I haven't actually done it in a long time. Live streaming. I used to live stream every single week, and the thing about animation live streams is they're really boring. I mean,
Oh
so
no,
having your
they're
friends,
exciting. I love animation live streams.
I think they're very boring. Maybe not.
Consuming them or producing them?
No, consuming them. So let's say there's a couple animators I follow and they do the live stream thing. What I do is I go in and I see what they're working on and I kind of see what they have set up and all that. But then you know how animation is. It's going to be another few hours until they kind of make any progress. So unless there's an interesting conversation happening in whatever call they're doing or if they're interacting with the audience. It's I don't know, it can be really bland. And in my case, if I'm live streaming, and I've had my friends call me out on this before, I'll be drawing the same line 10 different times because I'm talking and not even thinking about it. Just erase the line, draw it again, draw it again, draw it again.
For a new viewer, that's quite an eye-opener, though. I mean, like, you can learn a lot just from watching someone draw the same line over and over again and be like, oh, so that one's acceptable. Why weren't the previous 9?
I guess so. I never really saw it that way.
I believe there's two primary types of animation live streamers. There's like the study buddy kind, where they've kind of just got music on and they're just focused and working. And they're good to sort of just have on in the background, especially if you're working on something for yourself and it's easy to get distracted. It's sort of that reminder, oh, they're working right now somewhere out in the world. I should be working too. Then there is the interactive, exciting kind, where it is a conversation. You can ask questions, they'll answer back, and you can watch each other's cartoons together, and it's a bit more of a show. I really enjoy making those kind, but the downside of it is it's very distracting. It's much more exciting to be talking to the audience than getting stuff done, and I really struggle with doing both. I would love to be drawing right now while we're having this conversation, but it's not going to happen.
I mean, I could. The thing is, the weird thing about live streaming is that when you're doing it, and the art will magically appear, and you don't remember having done it.
Yeah? That's
so
cool.
So, because I got the group of friends, and we talk, and we'll be talking about whatever, you know, mundane topic. And by the end of the stream, the art piece I was working on is done, and it just happens. My brain just makes it. It's kind of amazing. It takes a lot longer.
The best kind of thing to get worked on. I guess it depends on the kind of work that you're doing for the day. Like, I know one guy, he only live streams when he's doing, like, he's saved up a week's worth of roughs, and he's just inking.
Yeah.
So it's a fairly therapeutic, brainless task that you normally would, like, put an audiobook on in the background or something like that. Whereas I think I've sometimes made the bad decision of trying to do it while doing like compositing stuff and like node.
You have to think too much.
Based things that require a lot of concentration to make sure that everything is connected together in the right way.
You can't. The other thing you can't do while you're streaming is audio editing and video editing. You need to be able to hear the audio. And if you have people talking, you just can't do it unless you're streaming by yourself and there's no music or anything.
Absolutely. So it sort of narrows the field of what you can be streaming. And I guess in your argument of sometimes they're pretty dull is that the easiest kind of thing to stream is the dullest kind of work because that's the easiest thing to multitask to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've tried streaming all kinds of different stuff, but the easiest stuff to do is stuff that doesn't require you to be paying a careful attention. Don't be keyframing your animation in the middle of a stream where you're talking to other people.
What if you're being like super excited and energetic? Like you're not necessarily communicating with the audience, but more just talking at them about what you're doing. Be like, oh, what if I had another keyframe here and like do this bit? Oh, you know, this is kind of all right. And just sort of thinking aloud. That might work, but you probably need a very specific personality for it.
I don't know if it's popular. I just don't know. I guess I don't watch a whole lot of live streams either, so I don't have a whole lot of basis. It just seems like people who are playing video games is a much more popular thing to watch on a live stream.
Oh, yeah, that's what the platform's built for. But I think there's definitely a place for animation live streams, especially when it comes to independent artists. It seems to be the most practical way of staying afloat. Is that correct?
Because you're asking me since you just sort of came back into the independent field.
Yeah, you've always been in this game. I've never earned income from it. I just do it for a hobby.
I mean, I guess if the perception is that live streaming makes money, my answer to that would be no. However, I'm also not a person who live streams on different platforms. So, for example, Twitch. It has a creative community for streaming now. I don't know. Some people know how to make money on live streams.
I heard it's like busking.
Yeah, you can do that. The best way to make money on a live stream is to ask for tips. You're not going to get paid in ad revenue. You'll make like $3 in ad revenue if you have a sizable audience. So if you want to make money while you're streaming, you have to ask for tips and interact with the audience. Like I usually had, in the past when I did this, I had a message bar at the bottom of the video that would show in the live stream. And if you sent a tip, you could give a message and then I'd put it on screen.
Okay. I would have thought, like, for an artist at least, because you have something a little bit more to offer the audience than a gamer would. So you could have, there'd be almost like little commissions in a way where it'd be like, oh, drop a $5 tip and whatever their message is, you'll just draw it
Yeah, a lot of
within
people
reason.
do it that way too, and I've done it that way. The thing is, like, I guess your audience after a while they get worn out because they don't, you've got a certain pool of viewers. They're not always going to be tipping you, and they're not always going to be buying artwork. So you have to change it up a lot, otherwise, your audience gets exhausted with whatever the thing is you're doing. So for a while, I had, leave a tip and get a message. Some people do leave a tip and get a piece of art. And I've done streams where you don't even ask for tips. You just say, hey, I'm going to draw stuff from the audience's suggestions. And if you really want to see something draw, leave a tip. So you have to keep mixing it up. Otherwise, everybody kind of gets bored of the same old thing.
And you've seen different levels of success from those methods?
Sometimes you'll stream and it'll be really successful. You'll get a really nice $30 tip. I've had streams where I've gotten really big tips, and some of those people have become very close friends afterwards.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
So it's funny though, all of the people who have left big tips and been sponsors of me and who interact with me and talk to me a lot, I end up knowing who they are, and they usually end up becoming friends with me. It's sort of weird,
Well,
but
you're quite easy to get to know, which is good. You're someone who responds. A lot of people don't.
yeah, I think you mentioned one of your peeves last episode. My peeve is people who don't respond. But the thing is, it gets harder and harder to do that the more people you have talking to you. So I can understand why people who have a million subscribers don't respond. It's just there's so many messages every single day. But I try to make it a point to respond when someone, has a legitimate question or.
I think it's a real two-sided coin thing, especially in like in the whole YouTuber quest thing, because it's all about, oh, let's build an audience. Oh, hey. But there is a lot of joy to be had in a smaller audience, I think. And of course it's nice if things continue to grow, but I'm making sure to enjoy this phase where things are small enough to be able to not just communicate with everybody easily, but get to know them. You can tell the people who come back every video and interact, and I'll often go and watch their animations as well, or have a conversation with them on Twitter or anything. And it's really interesting to learn about different people's backgrounds and where they're from. And like it was interesting talking about our proper interview for your Scribble Kibble episode, assuming that's aired at time of by the time this one broadcasts, that because you're talking about, oh, what's it like in the actual industry? And I had to sort of move carefully around some questions, speaking as someone who has only ever worked in a particular area, because I know that's not the case in other places around the world. Like I had someone get in touch from, oh, I can't remember the city, but it was somewhere in like West Africa. And there just was no animation stuff going on around there at all. So he was just quite floored at the idea of being able to get a job doing cartoons at all. And it was difficult to really know what to say other than we're lucky the internet exists and conversations like this can happen and we can meet people from all over the world and you can still get commissions that way.
That's the topic. I had a big smile on my face because you were talking about how with the relatively small, I think, what is it, 30,000 you have, 25,000 right now, something around there. But that's still a point where you can go through the comments section and you recognize people who come back every video and you get to talk to them. And I just had a big smile on my face because I remember what that was like. You kind of think at the time that it's never going to change. You think, okay, I'm always going to be able to do this. No matter how big I get, I definitely want to be the person, I don't want to end up like that person whose stuff I really like, but they never respond to any of my comments. I want to really respond to my viewers and stuff, and I'm going to be able to do that forever.
It's interesting you say that because it has always been the same for me. My subscriber count's gone up and to like 25,000 feels really large, but my actual view count per video has always been fairly consistent. It usually tends to hover around 1,000 views per video, and recently it's actually gone down quite drastically. And I'm hoping that's just because my video output has increased drastically. I used to do like one every week or two.
You were gone for a while.
I was gone for ages. And then when I came back, it shifted from a video every week or two to two a day, which is that's not fair to ask everyone to keep up with everything. So I respect that people are probably only ducking in on things that sound appealing.
Yeah, yeah.
And my thumbnails aren't very exciting. I've sort of just got a generator for that now because I don't want half my day to be taken up by thumbnail making.
Templates are great. Just slap in a template, thumbnail, mm-hmm. done. So even if you get bigger and bigger, and obviously I can't speak past the point where I am now, I really can't imagine what's going to happen next. If I assume I'm going to get a bigger following as long as I keep doing this over time. But
it's a nice thought, yeah.
Yeah, even as you get to this stage where I am now, which is 250,000, so it starts to go up exponentially at a certain point, which is strange.
The snowball effect. Yeah, I think that happens for a lot of people. Like, I think it took me about 3 years to reach 10,000, and then getting to 20,000 took like 10 months.
Yeah, it's just like that. But the thing is, even at this stage, you still recognize people who comment on every video or who come to your live stream and they come to every live stream and they comment in like the chat area. You still recognize those people. So, you know, it's not like you can go through your video and respond to every single comment like you used to, but you still recognize your regulars.
Have you been able to have any one-on-one conversations with any of those super loyal, committed folk?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is some of the people who have super loyal, committed, have been following my stuff since I used to do this comic called Sin Wolf.
And oh, cool. So they go way back.
Yeah, they go way back. It's always interesting when I meet, sometimes I'll meet animators and they'll be like, oh my gosh, you did the Sin Wolf thing. I remember that. And I'll be like, but I know your videos and you do all this cool stuff too. So it's always a fun moment when you realize that you're fans of each other's work. That's always good.
Yeah, that's really funny. I'm not sure if I told this story before, but one of my old housemates, Nick, he's appeared on my channel a couple times. This is crazy scenery artist. He's really, really good. But he went and joined a studio at one point, and he was meeting all the people there, and the person who sat behind him, he was looking at the web page of like one of his favorite artists that he really, really looks up to, and he turned around and be like, oh, you know that guy's stuff as well, like, oh, he's so good, I want to be him. And that guy's like, that's my web page.
Stuff like that. Yeah, that's amazing. I love it when that happens. And it does happen. It's just really...
it's a wonderfully incestual industry, just as long as you don't burn any bridges.
That's funny that you say that, incestual. So I used to work in a completely different industry. And what would we always say? We always said, well, you know, the nonprofit industry is just a small incestuous community. It's true, because you get to know everybody. So the animation community is the exact same thing. But I don't know. Animation feels almost a little clicky. Because there's like certain high-profile animators who I just don't talk to. Independent, high-profile independent animators. Who I just don't really have a relationship with. And I'm sort of in the other click where we all talk to each other, but we're not really involved a whole lot with the people over there.
Yeah, networking can be tricky. It's always worth a shot. Send a message out to someone that you want to have a chat to, and you never know. They could very well be like you and just have an impulse to want to reply to everyone. And sometimes it's surprising where someone's probably really well known, but interestingly, they don't get a whole lot of messages. And hearing from someone that's really, you know, taking their lessons to heart and wanting to grow from it, you know, that speaks volumes too. I've been quite lucky to have that. Not so much like in the YouTube space, because like we're talking about like, oh, it's, you know, the pros and cons of having a fairly small audience, but I describe it much more as just niche. Because I focus a lot on the Toon Boom stuff, it's more that there just isn't that many Toon Boom people. So that when I go into the circles where there is lots of Toon Boom people, it's, you know, just a higher percentage chance that I'll run into someone that I know or has have heard my voice before or something like that. And that's a very humbling feeling where I've walked into a studio space and a couple of people have come up and be like, hey, you that guy? I'm like, yeah, this is weird.
So I haven't had that. I haven't been like to a studio where anybody has said like, wait, I know you. You're the person who talks about the animations and how they're made. You have that dog avatar thing.
Do you market your stuff towards studios though? Like, because like when I do Toon Boom tutorials. No. And...
See, mine's much more general audience. I have a lot of people who watch my stuff who aren't animators, and probably people listening now are probably just listening because they're curious about animation, but they don't, you know, they're not animators themselves, which is fine. So I go for a much broader audience.
I sometimes worry about casting too wide a net with that kind of thing, because I'd really like to do more stuff for just animation enthusiasts as opposed to the aspiring. Which is where Read Between the Frames and stuff came from. But those who are just there for their lessons probably aren't as interested in that kind of thing. I don't know. They tend to all get around the same amount of viewership, even though Between the Frames takes about 10 times as long to make and is also 10 times more likely to get copyright strikes.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Because we have similar programs. Actually, I think that's how we met. I don't quite remember. I think you might have messaged me or I messaged you. I don't remember.
One of your friends had seen Between the Frames and they're like, oh, this is kind of a similar thing. And then one of your viewers commented on one of my videos saying, hey, you got mentioned on Scribble Kibble today. I was like, oh, cool. I think I've heard of her. And I went over there. I was just like, yeah, I've seen this before. And so I decided to shoot a message just being like, we do have similar kind of shows, but they're like different enough. Like, that's cool. Let's
talk about that. I was going to say that your, because my show is more geared generally, and then yours is, I think, in my opinion anyway, covers a lot more of the technical specifics of, okay, this is how we recreate the scene from We Bare Bears, and I'm actually going to draw them and put it together in Toon Boom. This is how you do it.
Depends on the episode. I'm a bit more samey episode to episode because it is like, let's find a specific clip, slow it right down, and see what secrets sort of just come pouring out, which you otherwise just wouldn't notice. I've noticed in your show, though, you've covered so many broad topics, everything from animation breakdowns, which is where the comparison came from, to, you know, you sometimes do put tutorials under the same banner. And now, of course, the talk show style one, which is a whole new reinvention.
Oh, talk show. I haven't aired any as we're talking about this. None of them have aired
yet.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Spoilers.
But I am really excited to see how this goes because the more and more I've been working on it, the more and more it is not like anything else out there right now in terms of animation. So I'm really excited.
Cool. Can you whet our appetites a bit, or is it a bit spoiler heavy?
It's not spoiler heavy, but right now, so I re-rigged Scribbles completely.
Cool. Oh, wait, you've already done it. I didn't get to see it.
No, well, yeah, I should show it to you. We can walk through it and you can tell me how to improve it, maybe, or like what is weird or what you didn't even think of. Because I find this is the other thing, too. When you talk to other animators, they will do things in ways that you wouldn't have even thought. Even when you're teaching new students, you probably realize this. Like, you say, okay, go do this thing. And they do it in a way that you just never thought of doing it.
I was helping out a studio once and the producer there, she was convinced that all riggers just hate each other.
Oh no.
And like, not personally, but like, never agree on a rigging method and think that everyone else's rigging method is just fundamentally the worst way to do it. And it's like, I can see some truth in that. But I try to absorb. Every rigger I've spoken to has taught me something mind-blowingly cool that I kick myself for not knowing beforehand. And likewise, I've been able to show them stuff too.
That kind of brings us back to the live streaming thing, which is when I watch people rig stuff on live streams, that's one of my favorite things to do, is to find tutorials or whatever I can where I see how other people are rigging stuff, because you learn so much from that. Or if you can, even better, if you can download somebody's rig and get into it and see how they set it up and how they labeled stuff and how stuff is organized, that's always great. And then you can also, once you've done this enough times, you can go in and think, that's not a very efficient way to do that. If they had done it this way, it would have been much better.
Yeah, I've seen all sorts of ways. And sometimes it does look very, like, unusual. Like, so why would you do it like this? But then also hearing that, well, because it's maybe more efficient to put together, or it's less processor heavy. having really detailed rigs with lots of moving parts and deformers, and then you've got 20 characters on screen at once, oh, the computer slows down a lot. So sometimes a less is more approach, although the character isn't as flexible, keeping the program buttery can be just as important.
I mean, I've kept that in mind, but I certainly haven't had 20 characters on screen. Maybe I have, actually. You know what has been the most processor-intensive thing I ever did was, I think I threw, I created some kind of particle generator and had it spit out strawberries. This was a really, really long time ago, and I had a laptop. So what happened was, all of the, there were so many strawberries moving around on screen, and this is just flat pieces of artwork, but everything became pixelated. So what I had to do was get a certain amount on screen and then pre-render that, like export it, and then bring that image back in and start from there with the next level of strawberries, just because the poor laptop couldn't handle it. Yeah.
Yeah. Pre-rendering is great. That happened to me about a year ago. I was doing like the dust in sunbeams.
Oh, geez.
And exporting that took about 5 hours. And the IT guy was there watching, and he was like, why don't you try... because this had to go into like 20 shots. I was like, ooh, 5 hours for each one. And if any of them have notes, then like that's like a day lost, like just like that. He was like, well, why don't you just pre-render the dust? I was like, oh, yeah. I've done that before. Why haven't I thought of that? So after doing it once, rendering the pre-rendered version, not exaggerating, 5 seconds. Not 5 minutes, 5 seconds.
Because all the dust was done. You just dropped the dust clip in and then...
Yeah, it was just an image sequence. Like, whatever. It's as intense as any other image sequence.
So, okay, all right. I think that sounds like a good topic for the next episode.
Which is, stuff. Which would be effects. My favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, no, effects and, like, rendering and dealing with all of the... How to break a computer.
This is fun. Like, we're very passively creating a month's worth of content.